Good. So, like I said, we're beginning this new sermon series, essentially Reformation 500 in Luther's words is the sermon series, and between now and the end of October, we're going to take a look at some of the things that Martin Luther either said or wrote during his ministry. Now, I get that most people, when you start talking about the end of October, you equate it with Halloween, but we as Lutheran Christians remember a significant event in the life of the Christian church. It is the beginning of what we call the Protestant Reformation, and this year is the 500th anniversary of that event. Now, let's be clear, we don't celebrate the fact that the actions of the priest, monk, and professor Martin Luther split the church. That's not what we celebrate, because that was not his intention. Matter of fact, we remember that he was bullish, he was stubborn, he was unwavering, and all he was trying to do was correct bad theology of that time that burdened the people, that weighed the people down. And so he wanted to fix that and not start a different church or split the church. So in the spirit of this upcoming anniversary of the Reformation, I decided to gather some quotes of some of the things that Martin Luther said and wrote, which I think makes sense, which is easier said than done. Here's why. He wrote a lot of stuff. And short of reading everything that he wrote, which would probably take me multiple years because he was that prolific, and I own most of his works, by the way, I would never be able to kind of come up with a complete list of great things. So instead, I used, not only did I do a little bit of reading, but I also used the easy guy method. I went to the internet. That's how sometimes you got to do some research. And I thought, well, maybe there's other people who have studied and said these are some of the best quotes of Luther. And I thought, well, this might give me a head start in things to ponder. Now, as you know, the internet is a little treacherous when doing research. Professor Denny, is that true? Thank you. Thank you. And often a place where people don't footnote when they've gone to Wikipedia and you know it. Right, right. So it is treacherous. And if you're not aware, not everything you read on the internet is true. Just want you to be aware of that. I'm just helping out. That's my public service announcement of the day. Not everything you read on the internet is true. And so as I was studying and looking for things to talk about Martin Luther, I ran across this great picture of Abraham Lincoln that I want to share with you, and it really summarizes my research for looking for Martin Luther quotes. Now, photography was kind of a new thing at the time of Abraham Lincoln, and it was pretty much a novelty, and this picture was so good, like I said, it summarizes my research of Martin Luther's quotes. And it says, a picture of President Lincoln that he took with his iPhone, and then it says, please don't say this picture was Photoshopped because there was no Photoshop back then. True, Dave? Arnold? True? True. So he verifies there was no Photoshop in 1863. But this picture tells you everything you need to know about research on the internet. Not everything is real. Matter of fact, I found some great quotes of Martin Luther that I thought would really preach well, but the problem is he didn't say them. For example, let me give you two that I really wanted to use. God writes the gospel not in the Bible alone, but also on the trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars. Isn't that beautiful? I'm like, that makes my heart swoon. I'm like, I want to preach on that. Like, not only does God reveal himself in Scripture, but in creation as well. And, oh, the places we could go with that when we're Green Biz certified and, oh, look, this is great. He didn't say it. Yet, there's places, if you go to places like quotes of Martin Luther, there's websites that give quotes. Well, that's on there. And then here's another one. I've held many things in my hands and I've lost them all. But whatever I've placed in God's hands, that I still possess. I want him to have said that. I mean, neither of those quotes are bad. Those are great, well-preached, you know, kind of sermon quotes there. But there's no proof that he said these things. And people are, it's so bad that I was looking so deeply that I was finding online books where you'd open the pages of the book online and people would put that like at the beginning of a chapter and attributing it to Martin Luther, not footnoted. So I kept digging. He didn't say these things. It's kind of like the line of, well, if the world was going to end today, I'd plant an apple tree. And Luther is attributed to that, but there's no place that it's documented that he said it. So I had to keep hunting so that the words I bring you are things that I can say, this is where it is found. This is where he wrote it. This is where it is documented and annotated that he actually said or wrote these things. So I had to move on from there. So I have to go back to a quote of Abraham Lincoln that I found online. And once again, I think this summarizes my research. The problem with quotes on the internet is that it's hard to verify their authenticity. Abraham Lincoln. So once again, who knew he was so profound and ahead of his time in the 1860s? But once again, he helps us. So these were the things I've been working through for the past month so that I could start telling you a little bit about Martin Luther. So we come to a quote today as we begin this. And this is at the heart of the Reformation. Luther says, the law says do this, and it is never done. Grace says believe in this, and everything is already done. Let me read that again. The law says do this, and it is never done. Grace says believe this, and everything is already done. And this comes from a place where Luther gave a speech at a place called the Heidelberg Disputation. And let me paint a picture of what was going on when he said these words. This quote was spoken at a seminar 6 months after Luther had nailed the 95 Theses to the door of Wittenberg Chapel. And the summation of the 95 Theses, well, there's lots of things, but ultimately it was a criticism of selling forgiveness through a document called an indulgence. So he took umbrage at that, knew it wasn't biblical, and he said, we need to talk about the fact that forgiveness from God cannot be bought and sold. Now, that seems like a no-brainer to us today, of course. I get that. But back then, the church had so much power that it could do or say what it wanted. Matter of fact, they were raising money to build St. Peter's Basilica. Matter of fact, the same St. Peter's Basilica that is today in Rome, they were raising money to build that one. The old St. Peter's Basilica had been erected in 400 AD, and now it was 1500. So it had stood for 1100 years, and it was time for a new church. And one of the ways that they raised money was to sell forgiveness. Now, the way they did this is they kind of treated it like that card in Monopoly. If you've ever played Monopoly and you get that card that says, get out of jail free card, that's what they were selling. But instead of jail, it was get out of hell or purgatory for free. Now, you could even purchase this indulgence, this forgiveness for deceased loved ones. So they preyed upon people's emotions of, well, your loved one might be in purgatory or hell, so if you buy this even posthumously, they can be freed today. And people believed the church because it was the only source of authority in that time. There was one church, there wasn't another flavor. Now, because of all this and the invention of the printing press, Luther's 95 Theses had been distributed to a wide variety of folks and was already drawing attention to the higher-ups in the church. Once again, there was only one church. So in April of 1518, like I said, 6 months after the 95 Theses were released, Luther's already starting to take heat for calling out the church for selling forgiveness, and there is this Augustinian gathering of Augustinian monks in a place called Heidelberg. And it was initiated by the German monk who was ahead of the order in that area. Matter of fact, it was Luther's mentor, Johannes Staupitz, who said, let's give Luther a greater stage to explain or clarify his position in the 95 Theses. So this disputation was really kind of like a small church conference for Augustinian monks. And so it is this time that this what we call the Heidelberg Disputation, actually had greater effect on the Reformation than the 95 Theses did. Because he was able to clarify and go deeper into the idea that medieval Roman Catholicism was fundamentally different than biblical theology. Now, let me be clear, that is not the case today. So when I talk about medieval theology, that is not a reflection today on our brothers and sisters in the Roman Catholic Church. We may not agree on everything, but this is a far cry from what's happening today in the church all over. So in this creates even a larger gathering storm for the Reformation. And in that, he says, the law says, do this, and it is never done. But grace says, believe in this, and everything is already done. See, the world back then was different, obviously, than it is today. Back then, because of the church's religious and political power, they held people down by scaring them with the threat of hell. Matter of fact, they held them down that it became an obsession with people just to keep themselves in God's grace. And because they didn't have a Bible they could read, because it was all in Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, folks couldn't read the Bible. They had to just take the word of the church, and they kept people in check with the uncertainty of heaven. In many ways, it was oppressive. The people lived in spiritual fear wherever they went. And if they were told you'd be excommunicated, it would be the end of their lives, because they would have no connection to anyone, because everyone belonged to the one church. So they lived in fear. And if the church said, buy forgiveness, people paid. If the church said, you know, pray for the souls of your loved ones who might be in hell, you prayed. And if they said, go to church and give money every Sunday at the offering, that's exactly what you did, because they weren't sure that God really loved them. Now, the church of that time was very much telling people to do this and to do that. But the problem with that is no one ever knew if it was enough. And because of that, church doctrine was oppressive. And it was about control. Even if the individuals within the church were kind and compassionate, doctrine was very much oppressive, saying, do this and do that, and if you don't, well, you could be in big trouble with God, and you never knew if it was enough, so that you keep doing these things, and you never can stop, because when you get to the pearly gates, you're just hoping you had done enough so that St. Peter would let you through. So as Luther was clarifying the biblical understanding of God's will, he understood clearly that the church's approach was very legalistic, to a point that people would never know or have assurance if they'd ever done enough to please God to let them into heaven. But here's the problem. Doing stuff like this is like being on a hamster treadmill. You never get anywhere, but you're doing a lot of work and you're very tired when you're done. And this is what the people were going through. Boy, it never ends, and it never seems like we're going anywhere. And when one believes that they need to please God or atone for their past mistakes, there is never an end to making it up to God. And you might say to yourself, well, we don't believe that, and what does this have to do with us? We don't believe that. That really doesn't apply to our lives. But I will tell you that people still believe this in their hearts. When they hold on to the guilt of the past, of something that they have done, it diminishes who they are in the present, and it prevents them from moving ahead into the future. People still believe this stuff in their hearts. The law that Luther talks about tells us we're not good enough and we never will be, but yet we try to make it up and we let a past guilt or a past hurt define our present and our future. It still happens. And when those events happen that we can't let go of, what happens is that people are broken and they're defeated, and that becomes the narrative of their lives. they grab onto a false belief that maybe if I work real hard, maybe if I try to be a better person, God will love me a little bit more. Or they give up completely and they never step foot back in the church again. Either one is a terrible place to be because there is no grace in this. And it is the reality of even today's world, even though the Reformation is 500 years past, there are people who believe they are beyond the grace of God because of something that had happened in their lives beforehand. So Luther says, get off that crazy treadmill because it is the wrong mindset and it is not even effective. Instead, he says, turn to grace. Because when you believe in this, and it's not of this, it's Jesus. When you believe in Jesus, everything is already done. This isn't about what you have done or even what you will do. And this is the heart of the Reformation of the 1500s. This is what it was all about. Faith alone, not our performance. Just believe. It's not about doing anything to prove that you're good enough for God. Matter of fact, none of us are. Even the good deeds we do today are small and insignificant compared to God's love. And it reminded me, when I was a kid, my mom, when she would make us sandwiches for lunch, and sometimes the bread would get a little old and it would get a little moldy, and she'd just cut off the moldy parts. Now today, I just throw the bread away. But back then, we were poor, I didn't even know it. And so she'd cut off the moldy parts as long as it wasn't in the middle and still make the sandwich. Well, I see that our good works that are meant to please God are like moldy bread. They're far from perfect, but they are serviceable. Think about that. When our works or doing good deeds are done with the intention to please God, it's like moldy bread. If you cut it off, it's not perfect, but it's still serviceable. So this is good news for us, if not great news. I mean, I can't help myself, and neither can you. We are relying on a loving God who isn't put off by moldy bread in our lives and instead offers us the bread of life that never goes bad. And this gospel story that we read together is a reminder of that. And before you get caught up in the idea that Jesus is a socialist or even a communist because of how he paid the workers, it is a reminder that Jesus is generous. It doesn't matter how much you do or don't do. If the intention is to impress God, it has never worked and it never will. Jesus is generous. How about that? It's a beautiful thing. It's not about the things we do, it's the thing that God does. But even more poignant than this story really is, and this story really points to this in a very real way, is Jesus, who is dying on the cross between two criminals, and he strikes up a conversation, and one of them demands that Jesus use his divine power to change the circumstances. But the other one knows that he is receiving a just punishment for whatever he did. And we don't know what it is, but he realizes that he deserves the death penalty. He knows he's a bad guy, and he can see that Jesus is no criminal at all. He knows that in spite of this justifiable death sentence, he actually makes a request. And then he said to Jesus, "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Now think about it. This guy has nothing to show for his life but a criminal's death. He will never read the Bible. He will never, ever do a good work. And it's pretty clear he didn't do any when he was not on the cross. But he believes, and that's all it takes. So Jesus answers him, "Today you will be with me in paradise. Your past is of no concern to Jesus." He's seen worse. He's taken care of everything so that our future together will shine like the Son of God, because you and me are children of God. Amen.